All right. Well, thank you very much, Steve, for the introduction and for the invitation to be here today. I did spend up until the end of August, I spent the last 8.5 years serving as the chief economist of the House Ag Committee through both the 14 and 18 farm bills. And so this is the first opportunity speaking in front of Ron Smith where I can't say I'm completely off the record, Ron. So I know he's chomping at the bit to catch me saying something completely ridiculous this morning up here. And so great to be with you. You know, in the 20 minutes or so that I've got, I'm going to cover a few different topics. I've got several slides on the farm bill, just kind of recapping. May tear through those pretty quickly just so we can get onto a couple of remaining topics, both a little bit on MFP, kind of to set up the conversation that Dale's going to have later on China, and then also what just happened in the omnibus back in December. But I don't think you can talk about the farm bill without first, and I'll probably do this for the rest of my life whenever I'm talking about the 18 farm bill. We'll talk about the Bipartisan Budget Act of 2018. Mention it only because that was the vehicle that added seed cotton back to the farm bill. And I don't think you can overstate the importance of getting that done, both the importance of the cotton industry, but also to the farm bill process itself, because I suspect, I mean, there's no way to know, but I suspect that if, had we not gotten that done back in February of 2018, I'd probably still be sitting at the Capitol at this point working on the 2020 Farm Bill or something like that. And so it's certainly a very big deal. I think it helped pave the way, getting a major issue out of the way in advance of the Farm Bill. Certainly the improvements to dairy as well, both of those together were very big changes that really helped pave the way to getting the Farm Bill done. With respect to the 2018 Farm Bill, I think probably the biggest or most notable change in this bill, and most of the changes, there were no huge sweeping changes. They were on the margin. There was no new money in this Farm Bill no new money to write this Farm Bill. One of the most notable changes, though, was in the election itself between ARC and PLC. As you'll recall, under the 14 Farm Bill, it was a 5-year election covering the 14 through 18 crop years. Under this Farm Bill, it's a 2-year election. So you're looking at the decision being made right now covers the 2019 and 2020 crop years. And then beginning in crop year 2021, it moves to an annual decision. And so no more being locked into a 5-year decision on ARC and PLC. One note that I will make, and I've been making it the last couple of months as I travel around, is ARC IC, the individual coverage, tends to be an afterthought, largely developed for Montana and some of the larger northern states that have big counties. But if you did find yourself, if you're in a part of the Cotton Belt where you found yourself with prevented planting, if you're on a farm where 100% of the acres were prevented from planting that were intended to be planted, it may be worth taking another look at ARC IC, primarily because those acres, you're able to include all of those acres in the benchmark and guarantee calculations, and you're able to enter a zero yield. And so if you've dismissed it out of hand in the past and you find yourself in that situation, you may want to take another look. Another one that's similarly related, just a quick aside, is on stacks and the interaction with ARC and PLC. You'll recall out of the BBA, in 2018, producers were allowed to do both. You could keep stacks, you could have ARC PLC. And there's a little bit of ambiguity coming from RMA, but beginning with the 2020 or 2019 crop year, the law is very clear. And it's not as complicated as it sounds, but if your farm is a farm, not acres, but a farm, is not eligible for stacks if seed cotton base is enrolled in ARC and PLC. It's that simple, but there's a tremendous amount of flexibility that comes with that. So if you have seed cotton base that you enroll, not elect, this is an annual enrollment. If you enroll for the crop year, that seed cotton base, only then can you not have stacks on that FSA farm number. So it does leave a grower a lot of flexibility on what to do. And so in this quick scenario here, if you assume that you've got soybean base and peanut base, let's say 80 acres of both on that farm, you can enroll both of those in ARC and PLC, turn around and plant cotton on that quarter, and purchase stacks on every one of those acres. And so it's literally tied directly to seed cotton. It's if you enroll seed cotton, only then can you not have stacks on that farm. The bill also included another yield update. You think, well, we did one in 14. We just did one under the BBA when we added seed cotton back. Good heavens, why are we doing another one? Well, it's primarily because that 8 through 12 period was not a great period for everyone. In the BBA, we stuck with the same time period that we had used in the 2014 Farm Bill. The features there you see are largely the same, so it's a 90% factor. Instead of the 08 through 12 period, you're using that 5-year average from 13 through 17, and then a factor is tacked on. If you want to chat afterwards about where all that came from, happy to, but there's the table of factors. FSA publishes these For seed cotton, it's 90%. So you're taking 90% of the five-year average, and then you're tacking that on at the end, too. And so you think, well, if I'm taking 90% of 90%, you know, is this thing even going to be worth it? Just ran an example this week in Lubbock County. If you are mimicking, as a grower, mimicking the county average, this would still represent about a 17% increase in your yield. So I would encourage you not to dismiss it, to look into doing that update. Another feature in this farm bill was effective reference prices. This just allows the reference prices to float up. Doesn't do anything in the near term. It's more forward-looking thinking in anticipation of future farm bills. So just for something for you to be aware of in the future, that reference prices are allowed to go up 15% above the statutory reference price if the market actually ends up trending in that direction. There were several marginal improvements to the ARC program as well. I think for the Cotton Belt, probably the two I'd flag today are that top one. The first is that it mandates the use of RMA data as opposed to NAS data. It switches that cascade that Secretary Vilsack had put in place in coming out of the 2014 Farm Bill. The second one I'd mention is probably the second one from the bottom. Almost all of the ARC guarantees ended up being blended guarantees between irrigated and non-irrigated. This Farm Bill mandates the Secretary to go split them out. If there's any way possible, the Farm Bill tells Secretary Perdue to go split them out and to do separate guarantees. And so you already see it in the information coming out of USDA, but increasingly you're going to see far more cases where the ARC guarantee is split between irrigated and non-irrigated. And the decision aid that I'll preview here in a second covers that as well. The other then is on base acres and payment acres, and I know for some this caused a lot of angst, particularly in the BBA, how generic was converted. We had created generic in the 14 Farm Bill primarily because there was a threat to just eliminate cotton base altogether. And so generic base was a way of keeping, knowing that base had value, keeping it around and letting, you know, producers deploy that in their operation. Well, when it came time to adding seed cotton back, something had to be done with those acres. And part of the price that was paid to be able to afford the provision was unassigned crop base. And so there are acres hanging out there, you know, particularly those that hadn't been planted to a covered commodity. Well, the corollary to that in the 2018 Farm Bill, rather than looking at covered commodities that had been planted, is looking at farms that had been planted to nothing but grass from 2009 through 2017. And so if a farm had been entirely in grass during that period, no longer, it still maintains all of its base. It doesn't become unassigned like we did with generic. It just sits out there without any payments. The one exception to that is that if you do have base that you find in that situation, instead you can enroll it in a new, what's called the CSP Grasslands Conservation Initiative, which is a guaranteed $18 an acre through the life of this farm bill. One other quick point then on the farm bill is on means testing, actively engaged, and payment limits, that entire suite of limitations that are imposed. On means testing, there was a lot of pressure to reduce that below the AGI level below 900,000. The conference agreement stuck with current law of 900. On actively engaged, in the 2014 Farm Bill, there was a lot of pressure to ratchet up the requirements on what it means to be actively engaged, particularly for non-family managers of operations. To qualify a manager, went along with that, but put in place an exception that said if it's a family operation, it's hands off. This bill expanded the definition of family also to include first cousins, nieces, and nephews. And payment limits, it maintained $125,000. We had put certs in place via the appropriations process coming out of the 14 Farm Bill. This Farm Bill just wipes it all away and takes LDPs and MLGs outside of the payment limit altogether. In terms of sign-up is going on right now. The election, so that two-year election that you're making for 19 and 20, you have to do by March the 15th. While you're at it, you're going to do your enrollment for the 19 crop year, and then you've got until the end of June to do your annual enrollment for the 2020 crop year. When I talk to FSA, and I'm often at events with the state executive director, so Gary is often there, and I try to make a point of saying, you know, just because you're going to have better information in the middle of March doesn't mean we want everyone doing a run on the FSA offices at the very last minute and completely overwhelming those really nice people that work in the county offices. One tool you could use if you want is to go ahead and go in and do it And if you want to change it, if you decide, you know, the market's shifted, it's changed your kind of your calculus, you could go back in and change your election. But if you go in, do the election, nothing changes, you're completely done, and you don't have to go back in. And so that is potentially one strategy you could deploy. The second topic I want to cover really quickly is on the decision aid. We now have it up on our website. Has all the features of the 18 Farm Bill. It doesn't include payment limits and sequester, primarily because those apply to both programs. The third point there, I do want to flag is that you definitely have to be mindful of the interaction with crop insurance. So particularly SCO. You know that if you want to enroll in SCO, can't be enrolled in ARC. And I already mentioned the stacks interactions earlier. And so the tool does not capture that dynamic. So it's something for you to be aware of. I talked about ARC-IC primarily with preventive planning earlier. If you go to our website, the link there is there at the bottom. You'll see red arrow right there in the middle of our website is a link to the decision aid. You're going to be brought to this screen that says, hey, I can't actually predict how this is going to work, so don't go to your banker saying that Bart said you were going to get these payments. As long as you click through that, you can get to the tool, log in. You think, why in the world are you showing me a login screen? Because you can put any email address in there you want, and you'll be able to get into our tool. But the only way you're going to get updates when FSA changes information, when we get new data from the department, or if we find glitches or whatever, is we send out updates to whoever is signed up. And so if you use a real email address, you'll get an update from us with any changes that are made. Once you're in the tool, then you can go in. This is the home screen. You can click on New Farm. I already created one there, farm number 1234. Lubbock County Cotton. Once you click on that farm, then you can either go in and edit the information, but there at the bottom are the two tools. It's a pretty streamlined decision aid. So the first is the payment limit tool. Talked about the fact that payment yield update is going to be in effect for the 2020 crop year. You can go analyze it right there. The second one then is the expected payments tool. It'll bring you to this screen. You know, this is a cotton farm, so you're going to get a warning that says, hey, when you do this, be sure to convert to pounds of seed cotton, so convert from Lent using that 2.4 factor. Everything that's taken into account here is seed cotton pounds, and so be sure to do that. You'll have the place there at the bottom of the screen to put in your base acres. If you then scroll down further, you're going to be able to put in your yields. So this pulls directly over from the yield update tool. That second one there, I pulled straight from the averages of Lubbock County and resulted in about a 17% increase in yield over that 1,020-pound seed cotton average yield in Lubbock County. You can then put in your seed cotton price expectations, or if you hit the green button over there, it just loads the projections that we pull from our partners, FAPRI at the University of Missouri, but you can toy with it and put in your own. Hit calculate, recalculate, and it's going to give you the results between ARC and PLC there at the bottom. I will say, in almost every case, you're going to see PLC dominating just given the price outlook. You know, the things to think about is that if 19 ended up being a particularly bad year in your county, you might not want to use the trend yield averages that we're using. So you could click that little box down there at the bottom on advanced settings. You can override the yield if you want to toy around and put in your own yields. You could do that. Again, SCO stacks also factor into this as well. But absent that, in most cases, PLC, particularly on seed cotton, is going to show to be preferred. If you have any questions at all, that's our direct number. If you have any question, need help on anything with the decision aid, feel free to call that number. You can ask for me. You can ask for anyone. A couple of others, and Steve can tell me when I need to quit talking and sit down, but the last two topics, wanted to briefly cover MFP and briefly cover the omnibus. So on MFP, here lately, particularly on MFP 2.0, there has been some chatter about, well, this second round of MFP, kind of the pendulum swung and the secretary really tilted this more towards the south, that there's a southern bias. That argument is largely being made by just simply looking at the county rates that the secretary published. And kind of what's going on behind the scenes there is naturally, if you're in a county that's dominated by cotton, you're going to have a very cotton-specific rate that's pretty significant. If you then compare that to the Midwest, where that county rate is not, it's dominated by soybeans, but it's paid over all acres, both soybeans and corn, the county average rate, you know, if you just look at it on the surface, you think, well, they're higher here than they are there. The question I have, though, is, well, where is the money actually going? When all of this is brought together, where are those payments going? And is there a Southern bias in the payments? Those are the top 10 states. I'll leave you to draw your own conclusions. Texas is on the list, certainly as the third largest recipient. On all of the other top 10 states, does anyone see a Southern state in that list? Maybe I missed it. Another way to look at it, here it is broken down by census region. If you take all the summary of MFP payments by census region, the Midwest is coming in right at $7.5 billion, which is more than double the rest of the country combined. And so, again, I'll leave you to draw your own conclusions. I think it's probably obvious what my conclusion is. A quick question that I often get asked is, well, what about 3.0? You know, this morning in the news, there's even questions about the third tranche of the second round of MFP, about whether that's going to be made. I still tend to think that I can't imagine a scenario where that ultimately isn't paid, but stranger things have happened. And so that's still in question. But then you get to this, you know, on the third round. And, you know, I'm often asked, you know, is there going to be one? You know, what factors are you looking towards? And, you know, I think the main factor I'm looking for is the president either in the Oval Office or in the Roosevelt Room making an announcement that USDA is going to go do a third round. That's really the only factor that ultimately matters. But when I kind of look at the outlook, all eyes are going to be on the Phase 1 agreement. Dale's going to talk about that in more detail. He's going to talk about it more. I don't know that there's many details to talk about, but also look for the market response that comes from that. That's all eyes are on that right now. What I'm looking at is that if I'm a banker, if I'm a producer, the crop insurance contract that I'm signing is the indication of how much support I have sitting under my operation going into this crop year. And so I'm looking at that price that right now, me, Bart, I'm looking most closely at the price discovery period on the March 15th sales closing date. So that's pretty much all of corn, most of cotton in West Texas, not in the southern part of the state, but certainly in West Texas. And so what I looked at in these two slides is, if you take February 28th, which is the end of the discovery period, it kind of back up 100 days. So there's 19 trading days in February where the price is discovered. But if you kind of look up leading up to and including that period, that yellow period is essentially February. 100 would be February 28th. And if you look at what's happened the last 3 years, you know, in 18 and 19, we made MFP payments. So the blue line is the cotton number 2 December futures contract, which is the contract off of which prices are discovered for the planting price on crop insurance. So blue is the 18 contract. Orange is the 19 contract. Gray is the 20 contract. You know, we paid MFP in 18 and 19. You know, we have this Phase 1 agreement in place, but yet look at where the December contract is trading. Unless details start coming out that really send the market north, we're looking at potentially a level of support in crop insurance that's below where we were the last 2 years. In that case, I think there's going to be an outcry, you know, to the president of, you know, look, we're facing this year, you know, with a crop insurance contract that's at or below, you know, break even yet again, despite of all this progress that is made. And so, you know, that's not the end all be all. You know, certainly things could rebound after that, which is one reason why they've tended to phase these things in, you know, pay them in segments. But it's certainly something to look at. This is corn. Not terribly different, tracking pretty close alongside of 19. And in the couple of minutes I have remaining, we're going to really quickly cover what just happened in December. So out of the BBA in 18, followed by the June supplemental earlier this year, we had WIP and WIP Plus that were developed as ad hoc disaster. In this budget, or in this omnibus package that just passed, quality losses, drought, and excessive moisture were added to WIP Plus. For drought, those losses only qualify in counties with D3 or higher for the 18 and 19 crop years. The way WIP works is the higher your crop insurance coverage level, the higher your WIP factor. That's the table that's there. On payment limits, particularly if your income is more than 75% from farming, you're looking at a $250,000 annual payment limitation with a combined $500,000 limitation over the 18, 19, and 20 crop years. We've got a paper coming out hopefully next week to kind of walk through this more, since I'm going to need to wrap up. This is the map of D3. You know, the lightest areas would qualify on drought in 18. That middle shading, so right in the heart of Texas, right off of the coast in the southeastern part of the U.S., qualifies on 19, and then the darkest would qualify in both areas. Secretary is going to be putting out rules this spring, so all of this is preliminary, but it gives you an indication. This last slide, which I won't walk through all just in the interest of time, just walks through an example of how this works. The bottom line, if you look down at the very bottom, if you look at WIP value, it's not terribly dissimilar from calculating insurance guarantee. You take the expected value of your crop. Instead of multiplying it by your coverage level, you multiply it by that WIP factor. So in this example, you've got 70% coverage. Your WIP factor, 87.5%. You end up with a $479,000 guarantee. Long story short, you back out other sources of revenue. So you take that 479, you back out actual revenue. So I had said that there's 200 pounds. You back out any salvage value here, zero. Take it by your share. Take it by a payment factor, which is mainly an unharvested factor. So the rate will go down a little bit if you didn't have to harvest, mainly to offset the fact that you didn't incur harvest costs. And then you back out your indemnity, and you're left then with the resulting payment. And so in parts of the country that have not already qualified for WIP Plus, that will newly qualify based on drought, will be a very big thing and should be coming this spring. So with that, thanks again for having me, and I will stop there.